It's good to see each and every one of you here this morning. It's good to be here. It's good to have Janice still with me. Ed and Eddie and James and Aaron left this morning bright and early and are headed up to Michigan to go see the great-grandparents up there, and then they'll travel and eventually end up in Texas with Janice and then eventually come home. So y'all are stuck with me for a little while again. I did want to mention, for those who may not have gotten a text or seen it on Facebook, that we found out on Thursday that we're having another boy. So Isaiah Keith Kozor will be here sometime, Lord willing, in November. So we're looking forward to that. Ezra chapter 9. We will be continuing our study of the Old Testament books of the Bible this morning and this evening, as we notice the summary of the book of Ezra this evening. But this morning we're going to go through and study Ezra chapters 9 and 10. And from a certain perspective, looking at it and hopefully applying some things to our lives as we look at it. But I want to begin with this. Now, I had something that I had my wife pick up from the store yesterday that I was going to use for an illustration. And I left it at the house when we walked over this morning. Didn't even think of it till about 10 minutes ago. But I'm pretty certain every one of you has come into contact with it at some point in your life. Called magnets. You know what a magnet is? Alright, pretty sure you do. Have you ever taken a magnet, and this is something I used to do growing up, playing with magnets, and I'm sure everybody else has done it. You take one and you hold it still, and you take another one, the side that's attracted, and you just start creeping it away from it and see at what point the attraction is not strong enough to hold it anymore. Or to cause it to come back. It works really well with ball magnets. Better necessarily than flat surface magnets, because then you can get the ball to roll back. That's always more enjoyable when you're a kid. You know, sin's like that sometimes, isn't it? Those sins of your past that sometimes draw you back. You've left them. It doesn't mean that their temptations and their grip on you is entirely gone. And sometimes our lives become disrupted. Sometimes our spiritual lives become destroyed because of the sins of our past that drag us back into doing what we had done in the past. Probably the strongest magnet for most people when it comes to sin is their former life. But one of the other strong magnets that can be a problem in many individuals' lives is not their former life, not what they were before they were a Christian, but their heritage. How many times do we see the proverb that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree being worked out in people's lives? You can just go to the scientific testimony of how much more likely an individual is to be an alcoholic if their parents or one of their parents was an alcoholic. How much more likely they are to smoke if one of their parents was a smoker. It's just simply that way. We have the tendency to be drawn to the same actions, whether we like them or not. We have a tendency to be drawn to the same actions that our parents were involved in. Now, for those of us who are parents, it's not any harder than noticing as we go through our daily lives and as we discipline our children or as we talk to them in certain ways, oh, I'm sounding just like my dad. Or my mother would have said it the exact same way in the exact same... You're just doing what your parents did. Now, there are some areas where that's good. You know, there's some positive things. But my mother always had a tendency of pointing out, why do you only pick up our bad habits? Isn't it true? Why is it that our children only pick up our bad habits naturally? You got to beat the good habits into them. In Ezra chapter 9, Ezra has come to Jerusalem for the first time in his life, most likely. He's a priest, but he grew up in Babylonian captivity. He's a scribe, and most likely the one who, by his influence, originated the scribes that we read about in the first century, those whose responsibility was the exact copying of the old law. And he comes to Jerusalem, where the remnant had returned under Zerubbabel a number of years earlier. And he gets there. And when he arrives, he's confronted by sin. Ezra chapter 9 and verse 1, when these things were done, the leaders came to me saying, the people and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Egyptians, and the Amorites. The report comes to Ezra that the people of Israel have not remained faithful. They've returned. The remnant has come back. They come back into the land. God has delivered them out of captivity, out of the hands of Babylon, out of the hands of the Medes and Persians by the declaration of Cyrus, king of Persia. And they've come back into the land and they've begun to intermarry with the same people that they had intermarried with before. The same people, the same nations, the same sins, the same abominations that got them driven into captivity in the first place. They've done what their parents did. Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32 and verse 1. Isaiah chapter 1 verse 4, Jeremiah chapter 7 verse 26, we're going to get to all three of those. But they all three point out that this idea of the sins of your past or the sins of your heritage, the sins of your parents have sway, have hold. They're stronger. Exodus chapter 32 and verse 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that that shall go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Moses has gone up into Mount Sinai. He's there within the cloud. He's covered. He can't be seen. He's receiving the law, but they don't know what's happened to him. He's been gone for almost 40 days and 40 nights. And so they come to Aaron and they say, "Make us gods that shall go before us." Turn to Joshua chapter 24, verse 12. Joshua gives us a little bit more insight into this as he gives that closing speech to the children of Israel before he is to die. Joshua chapter 24, and we generally read verse 15, "Choose you this day whom you will serve." But go back to verse 14. Verse 14, "Now therefore fear the Lord. Serve Him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river," on the other side of Jordan, "and in Egypt serve the Lord." The people of Israel did not remain faithful to Jehovah alone, faithful to God consistently throughout their time in Egypt as slaves. They began to give in to the idolatry of the land. And God calls them out of Egypt. He calls them out of bondage. He calls them out of sin. He gives them this revelation. He gives them this testimony. He gives them this law. And He says, don't you go serve other gods. And when you get into the land, don't marry the wives, the women of the land, and begin to serve the abominations of the land. Isaiah chapter 1. The sins of Israel's parents were the sins of Israel, for they followed the path of their heritage. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 4, Isaiah says, "Alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward." They've turned around from God and they're going the other direction. They were headed the right direction, but something pulled them back and turned them around. Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 26. Jeremiah says it this way: "Yet they did not obey me, or incline their ear, but stiffen their neck. They did worse than their fathers." They saw what their parents did and they said, "Hey, I can top that," in their own sin. Jesus illustrates it this way. Luke chapter 11, verses 24 through 26, He's been accused of taking those individuals who were demon-possessed and casting out the demons by the power of Beelzebub, there in Luke chapter 11. And He makes this statement: when an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest and finding none. He says, "I will return to my house from which I came." And when he comes, he finds it swept and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. It's a similar point that Peter makes, 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 and 21, where he emphasizes that the individual who hears the gospel, obeys the gospel, and then turns around and goes back into their own sin and wallowing in their own mire, they're worse off than they were in the beginning, had they never heard the gospel at all. What have they done? They've allowed the sins of the past, the desires of the flesh, the problems they had before, to draw them back. The problem in Ezra's day. Notice verse 2 of Ezra chapter 9. "For they have taken some of their daughters," these other nations, "taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed is mixed with the peoples of those lands. Indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers have been foremost in this trespass." It wasn't just the people. Matter of fact, it wasn't even most significantly the people. But the leaders, the Levites, the priests, had done it worse than the people had. They'd become intermarried again with the people of the land. Exodus chapter 34. God gives a very clear command concerning this. Exodus chapter 34, beginning in verse 12. Notice what Moses says to the children of Israel. Exodus 34, beginning in verse 12, going down through verse 16, he says, "Take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst." This idea of a covenant, a promise between, it's not the problem of them being legally bound. It's a problem of it being a snare and these people having an influence over Israel. Verse 13, "But you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other god. For the Lord, whose name is jealous is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifices to their gods, and one of them invites you, and you eat of his sacrifice. And you take of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. He says, don't even make an agreement, a covenant with them, for when you make a covenant with them, you begin to spend time with them, you begin to associate with them, then they have a feast and they say, why don't you come? Just enjoy the food. Don't worry about worshiping our God. Just come for the food. And you come and you eat the sacrifice. And then you get closer associated with them. And then you begin to say, well, how about you give your daughters and I'll give my sons and they become married and we'll just be one. And then the daughters tell the sons, come on, let's go worship. And you commit adultery against your God. You become those who commit whoredom. We see it working out that way. Numbers chapter 25, verses 1 and 2, that's what Moab does. Send the daughters of Moab into the camp of Israel and say, come! Come to the sacrifice! Come to the feast! 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 2 through 4, we read about Solomon and his foreign wives who drew his heart away from God. Children of Israel in Ezra's day are just doing the same thing. Just doing what their parents did. And their grandparents and their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents are just doing what they see. Ezra chapter 9, now verses 6 through 10. And I said, this is now Ezra praying, having seen what has happened, his anguish, he grieves, he fasts till the evening, then he rises up to pray. And I said, O my God, I am too ashamed and humiliated to lift up my face to you, my God. For our iniquities have risen higher than our heads, and our guilt has grown up to the heavens. They're drowning in their own sin. Since the days of our fathers to this day, we have been very guilty. This didn't start with this generation. Since the days of our fathers to this day, we have been very guilty, and our iniquities, for our iniquities, we, our kings, and our priests have been delivered into the hand of the kings of the land, to the sword, to captivity, to plunder, and to humiliation, as it is this day. Here's the remnant. The few that have been brought back to Jerusalem, brought back into the land, and guess what? They've done the same thing that their fathers did that caused their fathers to be taken into captivity. From king down to lowliest individual. And Ezra says, I can't even lift my head to pray to you. Verse 8. And now for a little while grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape, to give us a peg in His holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a measure of revival in our bondage. For we were slaves, yet our God did not forsake us in our bondage. But He extended mercy to us in the sight of the kings of Persia to revive us, to repair the house of our God, to build its ruins, and to give us a wall in Judah and Jerusalem. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments. When we turn back to our old way of life, when we turn back to the sins that we were involved in before we became a Christian, when we turn back and do the things that our parents did that were sinful, do we have the same mind to confess these things before God as Ezra did? But notice, verse 13 and 14, and after all that has come upon us, for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, since you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserve and have given us such deliverance as this, should we again break your commandments and join in marriage with the people committing these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you had consumed us so that there would be no remnant or survivor? Ezra understands the reality of the situation. If the remnant that God has returned turns back into the same thing that got the nation destroyed, what's going to keep God from destroying the remnant? And then there's no one left. But then, let's notice some New Testament warnings. You have in Ezra a clear picture of what it is to go back from God. That's the Old Testament. How about the New? Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, Paul writes to the church at Ephesus. And he says in verse 22 that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lust, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. He says, you need to put away those former things of your former life. Put away the former conduct. Put on the new man. But notice in this, he says, this isn't, verse 20, how you learned Christ. The example which you learned, the person that you hold on to in the being of Christ, this isn't what you see in Him. You claim to be Christians. What does that mean? Followers of Christ. If you're following Christ, if you're a Christian, how can you do that which Christ would not do and claim to still follow Him? 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter chapter 1, and in verse 13 he says, therefore gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust as in your ignorance, but as He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. God called Israel to come to Him and be separate. He called for them to come back into the land and be sanctified, to be set apart, to be holy, set apart for God. And they came back into the land and they married those children of these idolaters and they went back to the same sins. Peter says, don't conform yourself to your old life. But then 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, which we've already mentioned, but beginning in verse 18, he says, for when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through lewdness, and ones who have escaped from those who live in error. He says, these people, by the way, he's talking about people in the church. He's talking about false teachers in the church. He's saying there are people in the church who will try to get you to go back to your old way of living. They'll influence you the wrong way. It's not bad enough that you've got those sins of your past that are drawing you back, that are still nagging at you and pulling you back to your old life. But here you've got a Christian over here saying, hey, come do this. It's fun. Hey, do this. It's okay. God won't mind. It'll be all right. Sometimes people in the church draw you back to your old life. Sometimes, 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 3 and 4, when you put on that new man, when you stop doing those old things, when you stop talking like you used to talk, when you stop living the way you used to live, when you stop doing the things that you used to do, notice what Peter says is going to happen. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime doing the will of the Gentiles. When we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries, in regard to these, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. He says, these people who you used to know think that you're weird because you quit doing the things you used to do. You ever run into that? Have you ever met somebody from your past who you used to live a certain way with them back before you were a Christian, and they just expect you to be the same person? Expect you to do the same thing that you used to do, and when you tell them no, they look at you like you're an alien? What, you're not going to go drinking anymore? Well, you're not going to go to those dancing parties? We're not going to go carousing? What? What happened to you? Oh, I'm a Christian now. Oh, that. Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 6. And in verse 6. Paul says, knowing this, that our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin. Paul says, do you not realize, those of you who have been baptized into Christ, those who have put on Christ, those who have been buried with Him and raised again to walk in newness of life, do you not realize that your old man was put to death on the cross? He was crucified. He's gone. Leave him dead. Don't go back to your former way of life. But then the solution in the book of Ezra. Ezra chapter 10. While the Old Testament and the manner in which salvation was obtained under the old law was different than the new, go read the book of Hebrews if you're in the adult Bible class. There are things we can learn from what God tells His people on how to deal with sin. And from the perspective of an individual who's a Christian, who's dealing with those former sins, those former lusts, those former things that are creeping back into their lives, notice some lessons we learn from Ezra chapter 10. Verse 10, now while Ezra was praying, verse 1, chapter 10, while Ezra was praying, and while he was confessing, weeping, and bowing down before the house of God, a very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. First, they saw a righteous man being grieved in all sincerity at their sin, and it touched their heart. Verse 2, and Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, spoke up and said to Ezra, we have trespassed against our God and have taken pagan wives from the peoples of the land. Yet now there is hope in Israel in spite of this. So beginning with verse 3, going down to verse 19, let's notice what they did. Verse number 3. Now, therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and those who have been born to them according to the advice of my master and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Their response, we've sinned, let's do what the law prescribes. Let's be obedient to the commandment of God. But he says, let's make a covenant. We don't do that very much anymore. We don't often see Christians making covenants between themselves to be obedient to God. But it's all through the Old Testament. When Joshua becomes the leader of Israel, Israel makes a covenant with him. We're going to follow you. We're going to be obedient to you. We're going to follow you as we did Moses. We're going to be obedient to God. It's here. It's elsewhere. It's one child of God saying to another child of God, we will be mutually accountable to being obedient to Him. They made a covenant. Verse 4, arise, for this matter is your responsibility. We also are with you. Be of good courage and do it. Now, as one commentator points out, go back to chapter 7, verse 23 through 28. And Ezra had been given authority in all matters of the law in Jerusalem. He had been given that authority by the king of Persia, saying anything that has to be done from top down, including punishment unto death, is under your authority. And the people of Israel recognize that. When he comes in, he is the authority. And they say, this is under your responsibility. You're in charge. We will obey. So, for one, they make a covenant. Two, they submit to the authority. Three, notice verse 8. And that whoever would not come within 3 days according to the instruction of the leaders and elders. Notice what they had done is they had sent out word in all Israel. Everyone who had been involved in this, everyone who committed this sin, had to come and assemble together, and that if they did not do so within 3 days, all his property would be confiscated and he himself would be separated from the assembly of those from the captivity. He says, you don't come and you don't assemble in 3 days, then your property is going to be confiscated and you're going to be kicked out of the nation. They understood the cost of refusal. For Christians who've fallen away, is there not a cost for refusal to become obedient and repent? The withdrawing of fellowship. They have to understand the cost. They have to understand the consequences. Make a covenant. Submit to authority. Understand the cost of refusal. Verse 9. So all the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered together at Jerusalem within 3 days. It was the ninth month, on the 20th of the month, and all the people sat in the open square of the house of God, trembling because of this matter and because of heavy rain. It was the rainy season. And they're trembling, but notice, first and foremost, they're trembling because of the situation. They grasp the reality. This term trembling is only used 3 times in the Old Testament. It's used here. It's used in Psalm 104, verse 32, where the psalmist writer speaks of the earth trembling when God looks at it. The idea is when God looks at His creation, the creation is in such a point of submission that it trembles before His greatness. Third time it's used is when Daniel, in the book of Daniel, chapter 10, verse 11, has seen the vision and sees the one in the vision who's going to deliver the revelation to him, and he falls on his knees, on his hands and on his knees, and the individual in the vision tells him to stand up, and he stands up trembling as if his knees were knocking. He was so afraid of the one who he saw. The people stood in the open square for the house of God, trembling because of this matter. and because of the rain. We need to grasp the reality of sin. It needs to make a difference in our minds. But then verses 10 through 12. Then Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, "You have transgressed and have taken pagan wives, adding to the guilt of Israel. Now therefore make confession to the Lord God of your fathers and do His will. Separate yourselves from the peoples of the land and from the pagan wives." Then all the assembly answered and said with a loud voice, "Yes, as you have said, so we must do." You must admit your guilt. There is no forgiveness before God until you admit your guilt. Verses 13 and 14. "But there are many people." They say, "Yes, we will do as you said, but there are many people. It is the season of heavy rain, and we are not able to stand outside. Nor is this work the work of one or two days, for there are many of us who have transgressed in this matter. Please let the leaders of our entire assembly stand, and let all those in our cities who have taken pagan wives come at appointed times to their cities until the fierce wrath of our God is turned away from us in this matter." They understand this isn't going to be dealt with in a day. It isn't going to be finished in 2 days. There's going to be time that needs to be done for this to be accomplished correctly. So they set forth a plan to overcome their sin. Now, what I'm not advocating here is that we just kind of ease out of sin. It's not the idea. They made a plan to confront it, to deal with it, and they did exactly that. When we're overcome by sin in our lives, we must be willing to make a decision, make a covenant that we will be obedient. We must be willing to submit to the authority, whether it's the authority of the Scriptures or the authority of the elders, could be either one. We must understand the cost of refusal. We must grasp the reality of sin. We must admit our guilt. We must plan for overcoming the promise or the problem. But then verse 19. "And they gave their promise that they would put away their wives, and being guilty, they presented a ram of the flock as their trespass offering." Blood must be shed. Hebrews writer says there is no forgiveness of sins without the shedding of blood. See, that's one of the great things. Difference between the old and the new. Blood's already been shed. Sacrifice has already been made. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 28, Jesus Christ was sacrificed once for all time. So the sacrifice awaits. Sacrifice has been offered. What about you? Are you willing to put away the sins of the past? Are you willing to step aside from the transgressions of your heritage, if that's what you're dealing with? Are you willing to be like Israel and say, "Yes, we will obey"? If you're here this morning, you have need to respond to the invitation, whether as one who's outside the body of Christ or as one who is a member of the body of Christ and you need to come back. The Hebrews writer says, chapter 12, verse 1, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the Majesty on high." Will you come back as we stand and as we sing?